an odd one in the crowd.
So it's kind of odd.
They're decidedly odd.
Doesn't that strike you as a little bit odd?
No, that doesn't strike me as a little bit odd.
It's the Bob and Sherry Oddcast, with stuff we wouldn't, couldn't, or shouldn't do on the regular show. Now, here's the Oddcast.
Just about everybody knows Pam Stone as an actress, a comedian, a world-class horse person, equestrian, and now an author, also with a brand new novel out, and she joins us right now. Hi, Pam.
Well, hey, Bob. Hey, Sherry. How are you guys?
So nice
we
to
are doing
talk
good.
To you.
It is so, it's so good for you to remember me. It's been so long.
Oh, I see you on Facebook all the time, and I just love your post with your horses and your dogs and your farm. It's always very inspirational. You have inspirational words. Yeah, you haven't gotten out of our life.
Oh, aren't you kind? It's, you know, it's nothing really has changed since when I was doing radio before. I'm in the barn all day.
Right.
You know, and I have friends and Facebook friends who say, oh, I would just love to have your lifestyle because you wake up and you feed the horses and you ride the horses and care for all these animals, but you are held captive to a farm. You know, it's not like it's not like having a dog where you could like take a trip and pay your neighbor or get somebody to come in and walk your dog. It's like the list I have to look after each horse is like the Torah. I mean, it's like
Sherry and I have had people who like run dairy farms in Wisconsin on, and you know, it came as a shock to me because I'm not a farm boy, that this one fellow we were talking to, we would say, well, where do you go on vacation? It gets pretty cold in Wisconsin. And he said, well, I'm 45. I've never had one. I grew up on the farm. And I go,
whoa. Well, and he's not a rare one. One of our steady listeners, and one of your steady listeners, who we call Neil the Farmer, he does beef farming now, but he did dairy farming forever. And they've never taken a vacation. It's you know how the standard thing is, well, dairy farmers, they get in there and they start milking at 4:30 in the morning. Why do they do it so early? Because you have to do it twice a day, like 12 hours apart. That's why. And he was telling me how he had major dental surgery and had all these wisdom teeth taken out, and the receptionist from the dentist called to check on him because they were really scared that he would have an awful lot of bleeding and complications from it. And they talked to his wife and said, well, we just want to check and make sure he's laying prone. She said, he's in the barn milking. And they were like, he can't be doing that. He can't be bending over. And it's like, well, you know, we have 60 head of cattle and you can't tell that to them, you know.
Yeah, so it's right. We want you, before we start talking about the book and everything, to say hello to the newest member of our full-time cast, Lamar Richardson from Georgia.
Get out of here. Yeah.
Well,
I remember
doing?
Lamar. How are you?
Yeah. I'm good. I hope you are.
I do. Did you see how my voice just did the totally Southern thing? It just went up so high.
Yeah.
So in all those years in California, because I'm Southern, I get so excited. I would not take a call from any of my Southern girlfriends if I had an audition coming up, because I worked so long to get rid of my Southern accent. So I kind of auditioned for other parts. And I was auditioning for a part of a Midwestern girl, you know, and they have a very flat voice. And it's like, Dad, you know, Mom, Dad.
Right.
And so I had just been in this character for like 3 days. And so I'll just talking right to hear fish, you know, fish fry. Oh, for sure. And so I had a girlfriend call me and she said, oh, come on. I haven't talked to you in like 2 or 3 weeks. I got to tell you what's going on. I'm like, I cannot talk to you. I cannot talk to you. And she's like, oh, you are just becoming like such a snob. I can't believe you won't talk to any of your old friends. And I said, it's not that. If I start talking to you, I'll go back to speaking Southern because it's like osmosis. You can't stop it. And she's like, oh, all right. She said, but I just had some really important news to tell you. And I said, all right, what is the news? And she said, so Tommy and Missy ended up getting married. I'm like, you know, and it absolutely, and then it was over.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes off. And you know, the funny thing, and we've talked about this before, and it's a standard thing, how we make fun of, actually Prince Harry was being made fun of because he's been adopting an American way of speaking where the voice goes up at the end. Like that. And I was in England earlier this year and I thought, wow, we're so juxtaposed because in America, especially with young female, and I even see female broadcasters, never Sherry, but you'll see women reporting the news, and they'll say it when they're just talking on camera, the voice goes up, and then we're talking like this, where everything like sounds like a question, even when it's not.
It's like a Valley Girl thing. I hear that too, and I'm very, very surprised that they haven't exercised that from their deliveries.
You would think they would. And I used to say to young women when I would be asked to do speaking engagements, I said, listen to Oprah Winfrey, listen to Sherry, listen to Diane Sawyer, listen to how these women modulate their voices, and they speak with confidence and they are eloquent. Mm-hmm. And this is the way you need to speak. You can't major in journalism and talk like this. Like, so anyway, we went to the store and I bought a dress, and then we almost got hit by a car on the way back. And when I, it's like, because it sounds like, as Robert Klein, the comedian, used to say, you know, that's why we lost the Civil War, because we went onto the field and the general yelled charge. So, you know, it's everything when you end every sentence and it sounds like a question, especially coming from women, it sounds like you don't have confidence in what you're saying, that what you're saying, you're kind of subconsciously asking for permission to have that point of view. And then I went to England this spring, and the funny thing is over there, the voices go downhill. So I'm coming from a country where everybody talks like this. So my flight's at 5:30, and I hope I get a window seat. And I go over there, and my friend said, Pam, if you want some tea, it's in the kitchen on the table.
That's true. That's exactly their cadence.
Isn't it? It all goes downhill. Yeah. It's on the table in the kitchen.
Yeah.
In the red pot.
Americans have like this boundless optimism because we have so much space to move around in. And I think that we're more excitable and excited as a people. And it's sort of undignified for the Brit. Like, one of the things Americans get made fun of for is being loud and boisterous and exuberant and colorful and flashy. And I think that's just part of like our American sort of optimism, you know, Six Flags over, there's always a second chance for whatever. And that's a really big difference culturally too.
I think you're right. And there's a whole thing with the Brits, because, you know, my parents were Brits, you know, that never grumble mentality. And it could be just pouring, and you can have a tree that's crashed on your house. And they'll say, well, yes, we did have a tree come through the back window, and it did destroy one of the cars. But, you know, mustn't grumble. It's like, over here, we grumble and we cuss.
The perfect example of what you just said, this was, over 20 years ago, Sherry and I took a group of people to Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Landed, and the next day Diana died.
So you were there during that?
Yeah, we were, and we went, of course, over to the palace, and we saw all the flowers, and you know, people were crying in the streets and all.
Yes.
And my friend Barry Ward, who's formerly a professional golfer, now a travel agent, he said, "Well, I have us booked. Let's just go, and we're going to play outside of London, about 40 miles out." And off we went. I think it was in Kent. And two old men were professional caddies. And I mean, they looked like old Scottish men with the hats and the tweeds. And it's 90 degrees and they're wearing tweeds. And these are the first people that I've talked to since Diana's death was announced. And we were introduced. They were probably in their 60s. And they were our caddies. And I said, "Well, gentlemen, before we begin, first of all, thank you very much for carrying the bags here today. And we just feel awful about the loss of the princess." And they looked at each other and went, "Yes, yes. Well, off we go then."
Yeah, no, it wasn't grumble. Yes, it's a terrible. Is that crazy?
Totally. Just totally.
Is it,
you know,
that it's crazy. Just, I did. I actually, this is all horse related. I went to England this spring. I was looking at horses, and then I went to France for the first time. Then I'm doing a lot of traveling, which is very rare for me because I can't leave the farm, and I had to leave everything in Paul's hands. Paul's not a horseman. You know, mm-hmm. Paul's having to take video and send it to me all the time. Is this okay? Should he still have a tail on? You know, the sort of thing. Come back in the, and it's like, bring him, here's the halters, put the halters on, lead him into the stall, and you come in, the halters are like upside down, and there, you know, it's like, oh my God. It's like leaving, I'm assuming, I've never had children, but when you leave the child with the babysitter for your first night away from home. Your husband or your partner go out for dinner and you're calling mm-hmm. every 5 minutes to make sure baby's still alive and that sort of thing. So that's what it was for me. I go to France and I was there in June. First time I've been to France and I'm nervous because I'm going by myself. And what do we hear as Americans about France? That if you go to Paris, they're very snotty. If you don't speak French, they won't even try to help you. The waiters are very snotty. The people look down their nose at Americans, this sort of thing. I had the most wonderful experience ever. And I don't know if it's because of it's post-COVID and businesses perhaps have been struggling more. But mm-hmm. I mean, I was only in Paris for a day. I found everyone could not have been more helpful or lovely. And I remember going to the main train station, the Gare in Paris, and I'm really nervous because it's all digital. Tickets are on my phone, and my phone is dying, and I'm not mm-hmm. going to be able to find out which platform. I don't know the French word for platform. I'm just really, really intimidated. And a woman saw me struggling, and she said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I have to pick up this train." She said, "Oh, I'm taking the same train, and it's this platform." And I said, "And my phone's dying, and my ticket's on my phone." And she said, "Show me your ticket." And I pulled up the phone. She takes her phone and puts it over my phone and takes a photo of my ticket on her phone. So she has it. So we board together and she shows them her phone.
Isn't
How
that wonderful?
Lovely was that?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm exactly. So glad to hear you say this, Pam, because it's such a cliche that the French are awful and rude and dislike Americans. I've never had that experience. I mean,
I haven't either.
If you're making an effort to be polite and, you know, take a shot at bonjour, you know,
it
usually works out okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think so too. And the other thing, and I'll get off this, I was just so, this is what happens to me, Bob and Sherry. Whenever I go to a country that I fall in love with, I'm ready to move there.
Yeah.
I get I become like a neophyte of the country. I came back from France and I'm looking at French real estate because it was so the village. Forget Paris. Paris is incredible. Of course it is. But I was staying in this medieval hilltop village that was just happened to be voted the most beautiful village in France called Saint-Suzanne. They're all Saint something. Saint-Suzanne-en-Champ is mm-hmm. that's all I can do. And it was so exquisite. Wizard. And, you know, it's like 900 years old and very small and charming. And there was a little village school there. So I'm sitting outside and I decide to go to a little bistro to get something to eat. I'm a vegetarian, right? And so I say to the waiter as best I can I do a vegetable plate? And he's like, we can do that. And he comes out. Oh, my God. Well, so if I did that in America, and I don't mean to be anti-America here, but let's face it, you go to a regular restaurant here and it's like, they'll bring you a salad, right? They'll say, well, vegetarian. Okay, well, we can do iceberg lettuce and there's the onion ring and the cherry tomato. He brings out this plate of there's couscous. There are sliced heirloom tomatoes with the mozzarella, the caprese.
Nice.
There is sliced melon drizzled with balsamic. It is the most exquisite plate of fresh, you know, vegetables and fruits that they just knocked out. They just knocked out in like 5 minutes. And I'm sitting there as school lets out. And I look at all these children and they're all like, they look like the number one, all these skinny little kids. And I talked to the lady that I'm staying with, that I was staying at a B&B. And I said, everywhere I've eaten from Paris into this village, the food is superb. It's so fresh and tasty. And she said, well, you know, everything, the French, we demand good food and we know what it is. And we will not go to a restaurant if it's not fresh and really good. And I didn't know this till that day, but each school in France has their own chef. And lunch lasts about an hour and a half because it's a class and the children go into the kitchen and they will help maybe the sous chef. And it's not like everything, nothing is frozen. The chef is there. They use locally sourced food. And he's like, today we are having stew. And the kids watch them chop up the ingredients, or they're having whatever they're having. And then they sit instead of the long tables like they have in America. They're round tables with tablecloths and a vase of flowers on them. And the children sit down, and one at a time, it's each child's turn to serve, like out of a tureen. If the kids are starting with a soup first, so they learn how to serve and they learn manners and how to sit. And so it becomes a class. And snacking is unheard of. The children have a very well-balanced, healthy, protein-based meal, and then they are satisfied. And I saw that the whole time I was in France. I never saw anyone like on the train eating chips or chocolate or anything like that. And I thought, why can't we do that in America? We could do that. Schools could have their own cooks and have fresh salads. And I you look at the children and how healthy they look. And that's all I'm going on about that. So I came back and I thought, man, look how much French real estate is. And it's unbelievable.
Pam, my daughter Olivia, you know, my kids went to a public magnet school that was language immersion. And so in eighth grade, Olivia was a foreign exchange student in Lyon, France. And the first thing that she wanted to talk to me about when she called me on the phone was school lunch. And if anyone thinks, oh, that must have been a fancy school Pam went to, that's how it is in France. Olivia, because, you know, Olivia's in like an enormous urban public school, you know, K-8, and, you know, they had staggered lunch times because there were so many kids. You were in this deafening cafeteria, and we all know like what school lunch is. Olivia's like, Mom, we helped the school chef cook, and then we all sat at like little restaurant tables and ate for 90 minutes. They had a 90-minute lunch break. Oh, and on Wednesdays, on Wednesdays, the school gets out early. All the schools in France get out early so that the kids can have, you know, a little bit of time for the things they enjoy. Sports, family, the zoo, a nap.
Why can't we do this?
I don't know. If it was North Haven Elementary School, I'd be helping the chef make bologna sandwiches.
Right. You know, I mean, when I think of what we eat, like the pizza day, or it's all full of salt. It's all full of everything we shouldn't be having. And I don't even know if our kids in this country would eat those French meals now. They're so used to eating that food that they shouldn't be eating.
Well, not just our kids, but the adults too. But I think after a while, we would arrive at that being, you know, a really healthy lifestyle.
It was an eye opener.
We eat what we have, you know, we feed our kids what we have. And it's such a completely different culture. I'm glad you got to see that, because when Olivia called home with that news, I was like, wait, I want to go to French middle school. That sounds like a pretty good deal.
Oh my gosh. And now if you just go on the internet and Google school lunches around the world, and they show what Americans have, like typical, and then they show what kids eat in France and Germany. It's unbelievable. And there's no excuse, because it's cheaper. If it's locally sourced, you get it from the local farmer market. And so
You know what though, Pam? I think I know myself, and I think I speak for all Americans when I say it is so much more important to me that Elon Musk and Bill Gates and the Koch brothers and all get some dollars into those bank accounts while my kids eat a tater tot and a rancid hot dog. That's fine with me, because I want my betters to have their jets and their trips to low Earth orbit. Don't you? Don't we all?
It's like, oh man, we're going to start preaching now. And I have to tell you, if anybody, you know, for those that are listening saying, wow, was it really that night in France? I look up real estate. I learned this. Only 64% of French citizens own property. The rest of them rent.
And it's been that way forever. It's not just in France. It's throughout Europe. Americans don't realize that. And it's not something that people are embarrassed about or feel terrible. They're just used to renting apartments or homes.
They're just, especially in the cities. Now, in England, prices went through the roof in COVID. And because it's a small island and countryside is at a premium. So, you know, it's $500,000 for a small house in the country. Whereas in France, I'm pulling up Rightmove as like my favorite website to go to for European real estate, Rightmove France. And you can buy on 2 to 3 acres completely refurbished, the most charming stone traditional French cottage, hardwood floors, beautiful kitchen, you know, with the beams exposed, easy $100,000. Easy.
What?
Yes, I'm telling you, Bob. I'm telling you. We're going to go online and look at these. And there were dozens of them.
That's wild.
Dozens of them. Because the average salary is quite low in France. And so there's not the go for mentality to buy up all the real estate. So that's why the prices have stayed low. Oh, I'm telling you, you could have a vacation home over there. And this was like in the northwestern section where I was looking. And then it's not far from there before you go into like the south of France and Provence and all that. But even an hour away from Provence is still incredibly
still beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't get that in America. You couldn't get a lake home in America for anything close
anywhere.
To that.
No,
and these are so charming. You look at them and then it's just the little country roads and into the villages and you think, yes, that's where I want to retire.
Well, we better get to the book or we'll run out of time. And we want to hear about that. The name of the book is Girls Like Her. So that's a very interesting title. Why the title? And I hate to ask this question. What's it about?
Yeah, what's it about? So the main character in my head had been swimming around in my head for a decade. And I thought, look, you're either going to write this or you're not. And I used to love watching House Hunters International, and I love watching Escape to the Country on the BritBox. And I've always been enamored with these single people, especially women of a certain age that do make that move, like we're talking about right now, that have that kind of lust for life and wanderlust and say, well, I've always wanted to live in Paris. I've always wanted to live in Copenhagen or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they do it. They leave everything and they do it. And so that's what this book was about. My heroine, she's 69 years old. She's about to turn 70. She's done what every other woman has done. She raised her kids. She was forced to divorce her husband because he was mentally ill. And her mother was British, and she just felt very at home in England. And she decides, by the time she hits her 70th birthday, she's a breast cancer survivor. I'm doing this. And the book is about the response from her children. And she is considered all through the book in the beginning, when you meet her, she's one of these women that everybody admires. They say things like, well, girls like her, you know, she can do anything. She can, you know, she can, she walks around with a Leatherman on her belt. She can hang a gate. She can fix it. You know, she's dynamic. She's well-read. She can do everything. And then when she talks about moving, suddenly you can't do that. Not at this age, and you're a breast cancer survivor. What if you can't? Suddenly she's too old to do this grand adventure, when 5 minutes ago everybody's been talking how they wish they could be like her because she's the Energizer Bunny and she never stops. She's incredible.
I was going to guess that her children, when they heard about it, were appalled because of worry for her.
Yeah, she has one child. They're obviously adults. That is exactly appalled, and the other one supports her. And the lovely thing about this book, and I have to tell you, when I sit down to write, I have never been a writer that has a lot of self discipline, that sits down, that has breakfast, and then writes from 10 till 2 every day. I sit down and I almost regurgitate it. I wrote that book in 8 weeks, and it took 8 weeks because the computer crashed and I lost the first 7 chapters. Had I not done that, I would have written it in about 5 weeks. I didn't sleep. My table was littered with coffee and beer, and I was just like a mental patient, just banging at the keyboard. And and it all just came out in one fell swoop. And the main reason that I did write this was because I was looking around in literature, in women's fiction particularly, and I couldn't find anything about women of a certain age. It's all written for a younger audience. And I thought, you know, there's no expiration date on adventures. You know, if you can get out of bed and keep moving, there's no expiration date on any dreams that you might have had. You go for it. It doesn't matter. If you say, well, I'm 50 now, well, I'm 60 now or 70, you're going to be 50 or 60 or 70 anyway. right? So if you're lucky, right? Or 80. So you may as well do what the hell you're going to do. And that is what it's about. And the best part about this, you guys, is when I was doing, when I was on tour doing book signings for it, I had two women in a row standing in line. And the first one said, I want to tell you, I read this book and I taught school my entire career for 35 years and I have retired and had no idea what I was going to do. And I read this book and I contacted my two best girlfriends and we are renting a cottage in France for the summer. The next woman came up and she said, I'm 69 years old, just like the woman in your book. And she said, I was a ballet dancer in my career. And she's one of these women who can still wear her hair to her waist at her age and still look fantastic.
And look amazing.
And look
right.
good.
Very rarely can women wear long hair and look great at a certain age. And she said, I read this book and this is the second one I've bought and I'd like you to sign it because I told my husband I intend to spend my 70th birthday by myself on a beach in Spain drinking a glass of champagne.
Well, congratulations. I guess it's on Amazon, right? You can pick it up, Girls Like Her.
Sure, sure. And I did the book tour all for independent bookstores. I was very much trying to
that's even better.
Do my good for that. So yeah, it's on Amazon. It's called Girls Like Her. It's a great I originally wrote it to be like a chick's beach read, and it became much more substantial. And it was actually nominated for the Southern Writers Prize, and I didn't even
Excellent.
Know that. It was like, I think it came in like third or something, which was, it's
huge.
That is put
That's
together
huge.
By independent bookstore owners that nominated it. So,
Well, it's a delight to talk to you again. It's been too long, and I hope you don't have to write another book until we say hello. And continued success with everything you're doing, including your horses.
Well, thank you so much. Great talking to you guys, and always great to catch up.
You too. Take care, Pam.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the Bob and Sherry Podcast and the Bob and Sherry Oddcast. We would love if you would subscribe, rate and review, and share it with a friend on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, wherever you go. And thank you again for listening.